Tyler is Chadwick Chair of Civil Engineering at University College London and is the director of PAMLA, one of the largest research laboratories in the country. However, as we learn from this softly spoken professor, it's not large enough, so he's now overseeing the building of a laboratory in Dagenham. What's all this got to do with walking, you ask? As I learned in this conversation recorded before the pandemic, Nick is interested in the fine-grained detail of pedestrian behaviour as much as he is in engineering spaces that work for people. We also get an inkling of how the 2 metre social distance might have been decided upon once the COVID virus had struck. So, I'm walking in Regent's Park with Nick Tyler. You're an engineer. How does an engineer get involved in walking and pedestrians and human behaviour and things like that?
Well, I'm an engineer in a civil engineering department, it's all part of being civil. And so I see civil engineering as actually making it possible for people to be able to live their lives together in society. It's not about building infrastructure and buildings until we have done that. I believe that what we have to do is to create the opportunities for people to have their conversations, to have that sort of sense of sociality, which is part of civilization, and then you build your structures around that. And the need for a civil engineer is to be able to understand that relationship between society and the infrastructure.
Now, you spoke at a conference or talking shop, and you talked about that you'd recently been looking at how we as individuals, when we're walking, interact with each other and what sort of proximity we have to be within to understand each other or get on. And can you sort of explore that a little bit?
Okay, so in the 1960s, Edward Hall, who's an architect in the States, he started looking at what he called social space and what that meant. And he looked at people in New York and to see, for example, how close they got to each other, how far apart for things to happen. And one of the things that he realised was that there are spaces, you can sort of kind of categorise spaces by what is possible for people to do. So for people to have a conversation like us, you need to be somewhere between half a metre and maybe 1 and a bit metres apart, because that's the way the voice works and the way the ears work. So if you're further than about 1 1.25 metres apart, you can't project the voice enough and you can't hear enough to be able to have that conversation. So that gives you a sort of kind of outer bound for having a conversation. If you're less than half a metre apart, it's getting a bit intimate. And that means either that is a sort of kind of protected space that only certain people you allow into that space, or it's something very violent and aggressive that somebody's invading that space.
We're walking along side by side. Yeah, we're well within half a metre of each other.
Our shoulders are within half a metre of each other, but our brains aren't. So we are actually well within that space. We're something, I would measure this around about a metre apart. And that maybe we're a little bit closer because we're outside, so that the acoustics are not so good in that sense. So we're in a bit of a black box acoustically. If you go more than that, the kind of sort of sentient space that we have when we're in a space is probably only around about 3 metres. In 3 metres, you will know whether a person is looking aggressive or not. So that becomes something a bit like a social space. So the social space is where you can see, you can recognise whether people are smiling or frowning. You can see something of facial expression. You would certainly recognise people you knew and so on, things like that. So that's a reasonably social space, that you're not feeling pressured that you need to talk to somebody, because actually at 3 metres that's quite hard to project that far. Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't be talking to somebody, but you might be smiling at them. Beyond 3 metres, you start to get into what he called the public space, which is where you can see that there's a person there. You can kind of make out, you know, whether they're male or female, probably, if that's important to you. You would not really be able to see what their facial expression is. If it was somebody you knew, you might be able to recognise them at that distance by the way they walk. It's just much further apart so you can sort of tell if somebody is showing signs of being worrying or not, and therefore you can take an evasive action. Beyond that, you just notice that there's a person.
Mm.
So really, the social space that we're talking about for that kind of sociality or the civilization piece is actually sort of sitting between about half a meter from you and, say, 3 meters.
And does that kind of work also in a kind of vertical way when we talk about building blocks of flats? Because I always remember sort of being taught something that, you know, if you're more than 3 stories up, your voice doesn't project, even the most loudest mother shouting her child. And then if you're any further than that, you can't actually necessarily recognise the person who's down beneath you. Is that right?
Indeed, that is about right. I mean, 2 stories probably. Depends where you are. In Cuba, they told me 5. And that's partly because the background noise in Havana is actually relatively low, and partly because they are very vocal and external kind of people. So that these things do vary a bit. But Jan Gehl in Denmark, for example, he's very keen on this idea that actually if you can stand on a balcony 2 floors up and you can still relate visually and orally with the street, with somebody on the street, you could recognise them, you can possibly have a conversation with them in some sort of raised voice mode. But essentially, once you're above that, then you're into actually being quite separate. So I think you lose it a bit. But the interesting thing about vertical is that we're not designed to do vertical.
We don't have an ear in the top of our head.
We don't.
But we do have a sixth sense, though.
We have
something up there, because we know...
I'll come to that in a minute, but actually the spinal column is not designed to enable your head to look up. So actually looking up is actually quite a strain. We are much more attuned to looking at the ground, because that's where our threats were. As we were evolving, that's where the really tricky bit is. We don't want the digger, do we? So actually, the height thing becomes quite interesting. There's some very interesting work done in Germany a few years ago on people walking in straight lines. So they blindfold. They started off repeating an experiment which was done in the 1920s in the States by blindfolding people and asking them to walk in a straight line. And not one of them walked in a straight line. And they wandered about all over the place. And actually, they started going in circles. And actually, the radius of some of those circles was actually really quite small, about 20 metres or something like that, which is, you'd think you would notice if you were going around a 20 metre, but these people were quite unaware of it. So they thought, well, of course, blindfolding is a bit extreme. So they did a number of experiments. They took people to the Black Forest, and they took people to the Antarctic and the Sahara Desert, places like that, and they got them to walk. If they had any sort of inkling of sunlight or actually moonlight, they also did it at night, then they would start walking in a straight line.
Oh, if they had some light, yeah. They'd walk in that.
If they had light, they would walk in a straight line.
Wow.
And so in the Sahara, they tended to walk in a pretty straight line. But in the middle of the night in Sahara with no moonlight, they would go in circles. There's one occasion where the moon suddenly came out and they started walking in a straight line. So it's a very, very interesting thing. So one of the problems, we bring that back to our walking in a city, for example, and we were talking about verticality. As you build buildings up, so you're losing sky. And we kind of need sky.
Oh, now that's really interesting, because I have a former colleague. She doesn't talk about skyscrapers. She calls them sky snatchers.
Well, I think that's a really good way of describing it. So if you go to take a street in New York, for example, we have extremely high buildings. The amount of sky you see is actually very small, and your horizon is actually very short. But we evolved as hominids to have a very good scan of the horizon, so our horizontal vision is actually really very, very wide ranging, at least forwards, but our vertical one is much less good. And so a place like New York is actually quite threatening to us, because we can't actually use that horizontal vision, and the vertical vision is constrained by the sky. So that's why it sort of feels quite tense to be there.
Okay, so all of this kind of research you're gathering together, how are you applying it in your work Someone's not asking, paying you just to... Well, maybe they are, reading books from the 60s about experiments where people were blindfolded. There's a bit more to the Chadwick professorship than that. So what
are we doing? Okay.
Well, how do you apply that? And
so how we apply that is to see what the people actually do while they're walking along. By that, we have to start looking at things like how do their eyes work. So we do a lot of work.
Well, hang on a moment. Sorry about this, but I've been a walker and a pedestrian for a good long time. Yeah. I don't have to work out what my eyes do, know how people behave while they walk.
Kind of the point, actually. Your brain has a capacity to process something like 11 million bits per second of information.
Right. Okay, and yours? You're a professor. Yours surely must be higher than that.
No, it's about the same. We're all very equal here. You know? This is based on the number of neurons you have and how they connect. And clearly, the connections are something to do with how you use the brain. But essentially, you have a massive capacity for processing information all the time, and all that information comes in through your senses. So, and of that 11 million, it's a little bit over 11 million, but of that number, about 10 million are associated to vision.
Wow, a huge proportion.
Huge proportion.
Okay.
Right? And some people would kind of think almost all of it, but you could take hearing, for example. Hearing, about of that 11 million, about 100,000 are associated with hearing. So you think that's tiny compared with vision. But actually, that's only part of the story. Because the other part of the story is the processing power you have for your what we call conscious awareness. So the stuff you're literally consciously aware of. And that is much, much less. So your capacity to process conscious stuff is about 80 bits per second. So somewhere between the 11 million bits per second coming in, the processing of the incoming data, and the 80 bits per second that you're consciously aware of, what happens to the 10,999,920 other bits? And that is, of course, what we've just been doing. If we were to look back where we've been walking, we have not been thinking, or at least I haven't been thinking, I can't speak for you, but I haven't been thinking about where my feet have gone.
No, not at all.
And my feet are coping with all sorts of changing levels, changing surfaces. We have been clocking all sorts of stuff in our preconscious about other people, about the environment, about the weather. So this relationship between the processing of the incoming data and the processing of the, if you like, the outgoing conscious stuff is really important, because actually the 10 million of vision, 10 million bits per second associated with vision, converts to 40 bits per second in terms of conscious awareness. And the 100,000 bits per second of hearing converts to 30 bits per second in terms of conscious awareness. So in other words, hearing actually, although it actually processes, you have a relatively small amount of your capacity is used for processing hearing, a very large amount turns into conscious awareness. So the way I apply the research is to think of those 11 million bits and essentially put aside the stuff that we're consciously aware of, because it's so tiny, it's not really interesting, if you like, and think much more, how do I design an environment for the preconscious brain? So for the brain that we're not actually consciously aware of.
Right.
Because if I do that, then I can make the conscious brain actually much more comfortable, because it doesn't have to work so hard, and so then you can be more able to enjoy the things that you wanted to do. That's how we apply it. So what does that mean? Well, it means, how do we design a footpath? How do we design a street? How do we design buildings? And how do we design all these things? But instead of thinking about the sort of very visual things about how tall it is, or what color it is,
and those things,
we actually look at, well, I would say, really, the true aesthetics, which is actually the sensorial stuff, like rhythm and harmony and dissonance and things like that, which you are not particularly aware of consciously, but which actually is affecting the way that you're thinking. So the question is that we I think what comes out of this is that we think that we rely on our eyes a great deal, but actually we are also relying on other senses a lot, and hearing is possibly the biggest one of those. For a start, we get 360 degree pretty much hemispherical hearing range. Mm-hmm. We can hear, I can't see behind me, but I can hear behind me. We think not nearly enough about the acoustics and the sound that we have to contend with, and actually also delight in. I mean, it's not everything is a negative. So we can think quite hard about how do we actually make sure that we work with those things, and what is it about things like sounds and rhythms and so on that actually communicate to us and enable us to function at one very utilitarian level, but also to enjoy the world that we're in. And shouldn't we be trying to make the world something we can enjoy?
Okay, so I know you've been involved with something called Pamela.
Yep.
And you're about to be involved, or you are involved, in something which is sort of Pamela 2.
That's correct.
Perhaps we ought to have a quick little bit about, you know, what is Pamela and yep. Pamela 2?
So, Pamela is a laboratory. So Pamela stands for the Pedestrian Accessibility Movement and Environment Laboratory. So we're looking at how people move around the environment. So Pamela is a big space where we can create physical environments. So I can make a footway, I can make a railway station, or a bit of a railway station. I can create scenery, if you like, a bit like a film set. And then I can light it, so I can reproduce the kind of light that we have today. Or I could reproduce what this would look like at night. And I could have street lighting, I could have whatever we want. We can do that, any colour, any intensity, things like that. And I can create the noise around there, and I can direct that noise and make it move. And
this is physically you're doing this. You're not doing this on a computer. I mean, obviously there are lots of computers involved, but you're actually physically reconstructing or designing future environments in which to test how pedestrians would behave in them. Is that
right? That's right, that's correct. And do they fall over?
as mundane as that. Okay.
Lots of people fall over, and it's a fairly awful experience. So we want to try and make sure that we make places that are safe but also stimulating. So Pamela's been doing that for about 12 years. But one of our problems is that Pamela, now we have some horses.
Oh, no, Pamela, horses are lovely.
People who like horses.
Well, people who listen to it, they say to me, oh, we really like the ambient sound.
Yes, of course, because it's giving a context.
And this is...
Yeah, this is a wonderful sound because it's actually quite intermittent. But also, I was talking earlier about rhythm. Okay, you have a rhythm there, which is obviously the rhythm of the feet, otherwise they'd fall over. But essentially what that is doing is it's responding to our need for having rhythm, and that's because the brain aggregates sounds it hears into chunks. And it then says, oh, I understand this chunk because there's a sort of kind of beginning, there's a middle, there's an end, and I can understand it. And I can associate, in this case, one hoof fall with another hoof fall. And so on. It's just like, why does a grandfather clock sound so
reassuring
to people? Well, it's because it basically ticks every second, so it feels very reassuring, and it continues, and you feel comfortable.
Yeah, because I remember reading someone telling me about metronome walking. Apparently, all humans walk 2 strides per second. Could this
something
be plausible?
Like that, yeah.
And that you speed up your pace by lengthening your stride.
Mm-hmm.
Not by quickening your legs. Does that sound kind of plausible?
Absolutely plausible, yeah. But interestingly, we can actually make you do that. Why does a military band have a drummer? Is to give the pace the soldiers are going to be marching at. If the drummer changes that pace, then the soldiers will respond. And one of the things that they will do is they'll move further apart if it gets faster. And so you can have great fun as the drummer of a military band because you could completely destroy your very military-looking, organised platoon of soldiers by simply making it go very slightly faster, and they'll all go a bit further apart, and then go a bit slower, and they'll all come a bit closer together again. And so you can make your platoon look like an accordion.
What kind of environments were you creating in Pamela?
Well, we did create a lot of things like steps in the footway and things like that to see how people reacted to different effect of steps and gradients and things.
And sort of like tactile pavement.
Tactile pavement. We did a lot of work on tactile pavement, looking at not only the ones that we have legally in the UK, but also ones which are not currently legal in the UK, to see whether we should be changing things.
Did you look at this sort of kind of the shared space arguments and the issues around curb lines and who needs a curb and who doesn't?
Well, it's very clear that you have a real issue with things like curbs, because basically blind people like the reassurance of a curb because it tells them where the edge of their safe space is, whereas a wheelchair user, for example, doesn't want curbs at all, because wheels aren't very good at steps, so they want no curbs. So you have an immediate conflict.
I remember in Europe talking to blind people, and they said, why do we need a curb? Because what they have is they have a slightly raised line in the pavement.
So and in Japan, for example, a lot of streets in Japan, it's only really the main streets that have things like curbs. The rest are completely flat. And I think there is a sort of certain cultural thing, and certainly in the UK we like our curbs.
And the history of the curb is what? To keep the pedestrian out of the shit and drain water away from the footway or away from the centre of the highway.
Yeah. Well, they sort of kind of do that, but they only really appeared, I think, in quite late into the 18th, maybe early 19th centuries when footways appeared. There came the thing where it was decided that you should have a raised footway for two reasons. One was to sort of keep you out of the shit, as you say, but the other was actually to make it easier to get out of a carriage and not be in the shit.
Oh, I can see how important that would be for the people who are wealthy enough to afford the carriage.
To be and powerful enough to be able to do things like implement law.
Pamela One has been involved in...
So environments we've designed are things like we built trains in there or carriages in there where we've tested people getting on and off trains to do various things, whether that's to get assurance on the feasibility of a timetable. Or we've been involved with the design of the new Tube for London, for example, where testing how people, what features of the design of the new train should be incorporated in order to make the boarding and alighting of it easier, safer, faster, and more comfortable and more civilised than we currently have. So we've been doing that kind of thing. But the problem we have is that it's very popular with people trying to do that, and so we have a big delay on when people can come and do things. And so we're now building a new version of Pamela, which is going to be called Pearl. The name change is actually slightly subtle, but it's actually quite important. So Pearl stands for a Person Environment Activity Research Laboratory. So it's really about that combination of people and individuals, as well as crowds, the environment that they find themselves in, and the activity that they're trying to do. And it's that sort of set of three things that comes together to make a place good for people or bad for people in the end. And so how do we research that? So to do that, in order to increase the capacity of Pamela, it's going to be bigger. But also it means that we can build much, much bigger environments.
Now, from what I understand, the good news is you're using part of the Olympic Park for this.
Well, actually, we were going to use part of the Olympic Park, but actually we were evicted from there. So actually it's going to be in Dagenham.
Oh, okay.
And that will enable us within the laboratory to do the same kind of things that we do in Pamela, but actually to a much, much richer scale. Pearl will be able to build maybe 100 metres long street at full size. A station, we could have an island station with a couple of trains on it. We're looking to get an aircraft so we can do boarding and lighting of aircraft and design of aircraft so we can actually make them slightly less offensive to use. Those kinds of things. But also, that's at one big end of the scale, but we've been talking quite a lot about how the brain works. And so the other end of the scale, if you like, so instead of talking about whole railway stations or whole city blocks or whole streets and things like that, actually we can also study neurons right at the other end of the scale. So we can see what's happening to our 11 million bits per second by instrumenting with different kinds of technology to see what the brain is actually doing. So we're looking at some quite exciting new technologies for doing that while people are actually walking around. And because we're inside a laboratory, even though it's a very big laboratory, we can actually study how people's brain is responding to a different kind of environment. So we're looking at some benches here, for example. These are all sort of benches, but I also wonder why are they there, where they are. Well, they're sort of kind of under the shade of the tree. Sort of, kind of logic there. Why are they straight? They don't need to be straight. We don't really sit on straight benches. If they were slightly curved, you would have a very different social interaction. It's very notable. There's hardly anybody sitting on these benches. And, you know, in a sense, you'd rather sit on the ground. We don't actually have anybody sitting on the ground either. But essentially, if we made those benches into a sort of very slight curves, for example, like, but if you imagine a sort of kind of gentle S shape, yeah, then you can choose whether you want to sit on the inside of the S or the outside. And the one would be quite sociable and the other one would be quite individual. And you can choose, and you watch where you see these kind of benches, you can see people actually gravitating towards the bit. And that, that you'll find that the sociality of the people sitting on the inside of the curve is such that a new person arriving in the environment will interact with them.
Well, Nick, you talked about rhythm. How does that kind of relate to being human and walking forward, and how we interpret space in terms of time? And I remember reading a really fascinating book by Kevin Lynch, which was called What Time Is This Place? Another book written in the 60s.
I think one of the things I think is really sort of, I'm doing a lot of work on my sense of time and how we perceive time. So we, for the last 300 years, we've been, I would argue, sort of chained by the sort of Newtonian concept of time, of hours and minutes in the clockwork universe, things like that. And to a certain extent, we're being chased by that. But actually, our body doesn't operate like that. Our body is on a very different scale, and there's some evidence to show that the body's circadian clocks, or the body's idea of a day. Well, we have several ideas of a day inside the body, but the biggest one probably means that the day for the body is about 25 hours rather than 24. And so we're sort of in a constant state of jet lag. And every day when the sun comes up, or the earth turns in the morning, so that we get light, we get this slightly bluer light, so therefore you get, it sort of triggers the brain to say, now you have to be awake. And it sort of rejigs the clock. But that means that we're always in this current sort of state. And we impose that. It doesn't really matter if we didn't have to turn up to work at a certain time or catch a train at a certain time. That is something which we impose on it. So we're putting people under this amazing sort of constant stress that is so constant that we don't even think about it. And yet, when we are actually walking, you're actually reverting to a much more natural way of operating. Your feet are going at their natural rhythm. The sense of how we are actually according ourselves to the various sensorial elements around us, that is going on at a very much more natural rate. And so we can actually work very well with that. And so I think that sense of how we fit, you know, to me, the walking thing, why pedestrian is such an important aspect of the world that we live in, is because it enables us to think about time. And how we relate ourselves in time is expressed through the way that we walk.
And so, okay, would you like to recommend a walk?
Well, I'm a London chap. I think it's quite fascinating to see how far across London you can get without having to be on a road. You could start to think about that, because that, actually it's quite a long way. London has a lot of green in it, so that would be one is kind of challenge, I would say, to try and set out. You might have to cross a road occasionally, but you wouldn't need to be on it.
You've been listening to Talking Walking, brought to you by Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. In this episode, you've heard from Professor Nick Tyler. If you have any views on this interview or any walking issues, we would love to hear from you. Just follow the links on the Talking Walking website. We look forward to having you along for future episodes of Talking Walking. Written, recorded and produced by Andrew Stuck of Rethinking Cities Limited, our artwork is designed by Ian Martin of Aardvark Graphics, and the music is composed by Simon Sanders of Easytronic.